Say ah! In honor of Venom, up until this weekend, what was the most notable cinematic tongue?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with a movie that's not open for a few weeks, but I promise it's worth it because one of the very first things you see in Widows is Viola Davis and Liam Neeson making out, and you see some tongue.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm also going to go with a Liam Neeson adjacent tongue, and that would be Jar Jar Binks's long tongue, which Liam Neeson grabs in The Phantom Menace.
I'm David the Seven, and I'm going to go with the silhouette tongue kiss in Top Gun's sex scene, which was very notable as a child.
I'm David Ehrlich, and I have like 1,000 movies in my head right now where someone, like the bad guy, licks, she's like a sexy bad guy, and she licks the hero on the cheek or something while he's all tied up.
And I Jabba the Hutt?
Zenya on a top.
Thank you. Zenya on a top works. I couldn't think of any of them, although she is certainly not the only one. But I am actually going to go with what Patch has just blurted out and say Jabba the Hutt. That guy has a great tongue.
Ooh, or Catwoman in Batman Returns. That's a real good one.
Isn't there a movie where someone gets their tongue, like, chopped in half by a saw? Is that a movie, Saw?
Yeah, it's Saw.
Saw. The tongue from Saul.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 232, and it's the week of Wednesday, October 3rd. On this day in 1849, Edgar Allan Poe died in a gutter in Baltimore under mysterious circumstances. He didn't die. He was found delirious. It's the last time
he was a big difference.
Reading comprehension at the same time I learned about Edgar Allan Poe, and clearly neither of them stuck.
This is like super interesting because like one of my favorite theories about his death is people used to get vagrants off the street and get them like super drunk and sometimes drugged and take them to vote. And so they would like, instead of voting for dead people, it would just be gathering vagrants. And Edgar Allan Poe, famous drunk, just happened to get swept up in one of these things and given like a drug that didn't work well with his alcoholism, and they just left him in a gutter after he voted.
This also reminds me of my favorite line from the 2012 film The Raven. You know,
I don't remember the name, so just
is it Emily? Emily. That's all. Classic movie. Oh, we're getting old. Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently we still have some reviews from last week's deluge of people who were happy to have us all back in one place. David, catch us up. Let's hear some reviews.
I don't know where to start here. Let's see. What did we miss last time? I wish I could remember who we review we read.
Oh, boy.
But you know what? We're just going to start with the most recent. Vaguely Ethnic Jesus says, Carol, I finally watched Carol. What a masterpiece. 5 stars.
Wow.
That review was helpful. It reminded me of the film.
Was that 5 stars for Carol or for us?
For both. The review was very helpful, though. It reminded me of the film Carol as a masterpiece.
I was at risk of forgetting. Jesus. That's a good midpoint between...
I thought that was a good name for you.
Yeah, between White Jesus and Real Jesus.
Tyler Cinephiliac says, best pop culture podcast. Love the show. It should never end. Though I miss full film review episodes and would recommend some more format change-ups in addition to the rare quarter quells. You know, Tyler Cinephiliac, you know what I've been jonesing for recently is a good game of Patches Matches.
We had a trivia round. You just weren't here for it.
I was out doing my job. Jeez Louise, was that...
Emily!
Buckeye23M says, a go-to on all things film and TV. I came to this podcast via Republic City Dispatch and Storm of Spoilers, and has become one of my favorites that I look forward to each week. It admittedly took a few listens for me to warm up to everyone, looking at you, Mr. Ehrlich. You can't be looking at me, it's a podcast, unless you have a picture of me on your desktop that you're looking at while listening to it, in which case, power on. But now
stop
I can't
slapping
imagine.
On the desk.
What's that?
Are you slapping your fist on the desk while you're reading this review?
Well, yes, yes I am. But now I can't imagine and don't want to think of the show without each one of the four co-hosts. They all balance each other out very well and have their own unique insights and contributions. The show genuinely feels like a group of knowledgeable friends talking, and it's made me appreciate and seek out a lot more films and shows than I ever would have before. An enthusiastic 5 out of 5. P.S. Please don't fake end the show again. Or at least wait until Trump is gone. If he ever is. Because I can't handle the current hellscape with the added news that one of my favorite podcasts is ending. Patches and Dave, I can't believe you didn't take into consideration the political climate and how emotionally fragile we all are right now, including me, when you pulled that dumbass stunt. Was this helpful? Yes. Some of that editorializing was my own. I'll let you define what they're talking about and where the editorializing began. Also, I want to point out quickly that I was listening to Blank Check this week and heard a Storm of Spoilers advertisement, which was very exciting. Storm of Spoilers.
What does that have to do with this podcast?
I don't know. I was thinking that I got Storm of Spoilers.
We should be advertising
on
Blank Check, obviously. Yes.
And also the copy that Dave wrote for them is like very much about how like, no, Storm of Spoilers, not about Game of Thrones. It's an all you can eat pop culture cornucopia. You don't need to listen to Fighting in the War Room. Please.
Wow. Dave, did you in fact write the ad copy?
Except
for
that would be Miss Joanna Robinson, who was a big fan of the Blank Check
also
podcast.
The review we just got said that they came to this podcast from Storm of Spoilers, so in fact we want people to listen to Storm of Spoilers.
It's a great show. I'm happy for everyone to listen to everything.
You know what the difference between Blank Check podcast and Storm of Spoilers and Fighting in the War Room is?
What?
David listens to the Blank Check podcast.
Yeah, but if I weren't on this show, there's a much better chance I would listen to it.
Is there?
Yes.
All right, one more review.
One more review. Did I read Matt Pasatino's review? Yes, I did. Did I read LTSBLB's review? I don't... think, no, Lindsay, did I say about much? I don't know. I really got to keep a log.
Very engaging segment.
I got to keep a log. I did read the review where somebody calls this segment of the show the worst part of every episode. I remember that. I'm just going to call it there. If you've written a review that you know is on our iTunes page and I haven't read it because I did not keep track of the ones that I read last week, just tweet at us and I'll make sure.
Just tweet it at Blank Check Podcast.
Tweet at Blank Check Podcast.
David will see it.
David will see it.
Leave it in the Blank Check Reddit subreddit. I'll definitely find it there.
Experienced culture on Sunday. I went out into the world and saw something and decided to make a
outside culture.
Yeah. I mean, I left my house and went with my mom to see a live music. It's a thing that exists in the world. My mom came to town because it was a performance. I got tickets for her birthday of a guy named Randy Rainbow, who she has become a big fan of, as a lot of people have, since the 2016 election. It's this guy who's kind of a musical theater guy. He started making these YouTube videos that were political parodies, often set to show tunes. One of the recent ones is called Omarosa, set to the tune of Oklahoma. And there's one that's even more recent about Kavanaugh, set to the tune of
Wait,
Kavanaugh.
I'm sorry, can you say again what the name of this group is?
This is a guy named Randy Rainbow. That is apparently his real name.
Because there's a similar group called the Capital Steps that I...
Oh, yes. I'm familiar with the Capitol Steps. So, yeah. So this guy kind of, he started not in the 2016 election, but has really flourished since then. And I think what makes his stuff good and appealing is not just that he's like airing out his spleen about the Trump administration, which a lot of people really enjoy, but his lyrics are really good. Like he's creating rhymes and lyrics like Gilbert and Sullivan parodies that are kind of spot on for things that are about the Trump administration. And he's, you know, maybe doing a few more like tiny hands and orange tan jokes than you would need, but he's keeping up with the news cycle. It's not like incisive or surprising. Like if you are anti-Trump, you're going to find exactly what you're looking for in this. But that's also what I found when I went to this live show. I mean, I live in a very blue dot in a fairly red state in North Carolina. But it was like the bluest of blue dots, and all of these somewhat older people who, so my mom was saying that I know a lot of people she know has, have discovered this guy on Facebook, which made sense to me because I don't necessarily think of older people as having YouTube fandoms, but that's kind of what this guy has emerged with. And people gave him a standing ovation when he walked in the room, and they gave him these huge laughs, and he did a Q&A segment and, you know, talk shit about Trump there. And it was just like this, you know, cathartic release for people. I think many of whom don't necessarily live in Durham here, maybe live in more conservative communities. And like my mom lives in a fairly conservative town, has a lot of Republican friends, and like, you know, watches his videos as kind of an outlet to be like, okay, so it's not just me who needs this in the world. And it was a really positive vibe in the room, which I wasn't necessarily expecting after the Kavanaugh hearings and kind of how grim everybody was feeling. So what it made me think about was not just the idea of political parody through song, which has existed as long as politics have in this country, but kind of the idea of using it to find your tribe and like finding people who think the same way as you. And I think we don't think about this often because the media, which we are part of, is often in lockstep with what we believe. But does that feel like kind of the same thing that people are looking for in SNL sketches or anything else? Like, not just that you need to find outlet for you in reading the news, but like know that other people think the same thing that you do?
Yeah. Can I just take that real quick? Yes, because I've been wrestling with the value of SNL's cold opens, I think, as we all have over the past couple of years, and especially since the season premiere the other night where Matt Damon played Brett Kavanaugh. And I understand, I think SNL is a show, the writing has been, and it's not a particularly hot take to say the writing has been off. I think Colin Jost and Michael Che are very bad, the Weekend Update section is usually pretty abhorrent, but the, except for the supporting characters and whatnot, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and, all the rest I can abide. But, I did not only laugh very loudly when Matt Damon walked into frame and there was the surprise that came and everything that came along with that the other night, but through a good amount of that ultimately interminable sketch, even though a lot of the script was just younger comedians in old age makeup repeating almost verbatim what had been said in these incredibly stressful and for some traumatic hearings the other day. And I think a large part of that does come down to catharsis. I mean, I think that it is just after the week that was, it was as though we had all been holding our breath for a long time. I can't even begin not to sound in the kind of tone that someone on the internet would accuse of like virtue signaling or whatever the fucking incel term is for being sincere about other people's experience. But I think, I honestly cannot, as stressful as it was for me and because it was so stressful for me to watch these things, I cannot even begin to imagine how trying, Thursday and really the rest of time must have been for women and people who had survived sexual assaults. And I think we all just needed some sort of release. And seeing not particularly sharp comedy, but or satire, but satire that clearly dovetailed with like just, you know, taking a step back and looking at the sheer absurdity and insanity.
Absanity actually sounds pretty good.
The absanity of what happened last week and what is continuing to happen in this country, and just giving us a chance to laugh at it. In a way where laughter was appropriate in that moment, or at least in that context, where we were invited to laugh at these things, if only to have a little bit of air, a little bit less air caught up in our chests, in a way that we couldn't laugh while watching even the Kavanaugh portions and his hysterical performance, because the stakes are so high and the, you know, what they are talking about and trying to investigate is so serious. So I think that even though the comedy and the satire on SNL this weekend wasn't particularly good, as great casting as I think that Matt Damon was, his as a father of daughters comments and all, I appreciated it. I made sure to watch, and I think I got my money's worth.
But I just don't know when that breath of air that you're talking about should feel guilty, or when laughing at this somehow undermines the importance or makes it so that we're accepting that this is all happening and we become more casual about it. The more and more over the years of especially SNL cold opens, which, you know, because of work circumstances, I found myself watching every week, and this week I didn't tune in and have seen bits and pieces. I didn't really watch much of the Kavanaugh testimony. I could make it through like 1 or 2 minutes tops, and I've seen it broken into chunks, mostly through that Sam Jackson Pulp Fiction cut that apparently the Safdie brothers did. Yeah. Yes, I saw that on IndieWire.
It was made by the Safdie brothers.
It was made by the company,
So I saw bits of it that I just couldn't, I was so sick to my stomach, I couldn't bring myself to really watch it, and then, you know, watched a few seconds of the Matt Damon version and just also found myself turning it off because I didn't want to give myself into this anymore. I don't want to laugh about this stuff. I don't find it cathartic, and I would love to. I just, I find, I don't know, it's to laugh at that seems indulgent. I not that we need to take everything so seriously or feel this dread all the time, but I don't know. I can't
so
bring
you would
myself
rather be
to
laughing
enjoy
with
it.
Trump?
That's not what I'm saying at all.
What do you feel like in this
Trump administration?
I know,
that's a callback to his response to the tittering at the UN.
Oh, boy. What does feel like you can laugh at? Like, did the Sean Spicer stuff feel similarly to you? Like, you shouldn't let yourself laugh
You mean early on?
Or, I guess, Sean Spicer stuff? Curious about what Trump administration parody has felt like it's okay for you to laugh at.
Yeah, earlier on, I think I felt okay with it. And Sean Spicer is a perfect example of something that I did find hilarious. And that Melissa McCarthy, through that portrayal, really showed a weakened man, a flailing man, and a subservient man in the worst way possible, a total goon. I felt like that impression really exposed Sean Spicer and drilled down a bit further than just, a lot of these SNL sketches now, as David pointed out, really just repeat lines. They feel like, what was that movie, the Black Box movie, David, that, people were just reading the transcripts of planes that went down?
God. Charlie Whiskey Tank, something like that. Whiskey
yes,
Tank,
yes, yes. I mean, it's just like reading court transcripts or something. Yes. These sketches don't feel like they have jokes, and that's what makes me sick. That they don't have to lampoon, that they don't have to spoof. They just want to goof on the actual moments, and that just makes the reality more terrifying when I have to come up to the surface and relive it. And this whole experience of Kavanaugh and Ford, I can't bring myself to even chuckle at it. Even though I can't believe how many memes there are of Kavanaugh screaming. I find that to be such a triggering experience. And as David said, like, cannot imagine if I was a woman who has experienced sexual assault seeing this goon's face all over Twitter or Facebook or something. It's just so horrifying. So I guess to answer your question, Katie, I can find humor when the humor is piercing, and maybe I'm too far gone. Maybe I can't do that anymore in this current era, but I could have a year and a half ago. I don't know.
Dave, what do you find funny in the Trump administration?
Well, I mean, it's all funny to a certain extent. So,
funny in a nihilist kind of way?
Yeah, I mean, like, we're seeing, like, unprecedented moments in presidential history, and they feel really bad because we're in them and we're going to have to like suffer the consequences of them. But them as events, I'm always torn between like my responsibility to watch and cope with something that I have no actual control over, which until everybody votes next month is this government. So on one hand, you know, you kind of want to ostrich for your own self-care, but on the other hand, like, watching SNL is enduring their attempt at a political sketch, which they kind of have to do, and then enjoying Adam Driver yelling about crushing people into the ground. Like, it gets to be both those things. Like, your Rainbow Show got to be song parodies as well as political commentary. So it's kind of like a spoonful of sugar remedy, but you still have to keep your eyes on it because that's the responsible thing to do as a like helpless citizen. Like, I know I don't want to, you know, shun anybody that needs self-care, but if your large groups with American flags scare me, Matt Patches, I would say maybe engage a little bit more past your comfort level because it's happening. It's like history happening, and it's all very consequential. And so I would say, as somebody who like engages in lots of culture anyway, why not roll the dice on these things? And if you can, you know, find escapism in it, all the better. But otherwise, I think it's just incredibly interesting to watch everybody try. I think it's been, not since it's precedents I don't agree with that I like YouTube all the late night monologues like the day after, basically without fail. Not necessarily to find them funny, but like you, Katie, were talking about, to sort of remind myself that there's some degree of normalcy out there. And to me, that's these people attempting to make jokes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that I sort of find comforting. And I don't know how necessarily biting or funny it needs to be, because you could go out and have like these ticket purchasing experiences where you know you're surrounded by like friends, or you could, you know, find your internet echo chamber if you want. But I don't know if not engaging in it is super healthy.
Well, I always have the onion. So
yeah,
that's a scathing take I need.
What you said, Dave, made me think weirdly of the 9/11 issue of The Onion that was, I think, is still fairly famous. Came out like 2 weeks after 9/11, that like had all these like very sad and like kind of poignant but like really funny jokes in it, and like, you know, probably some that were like more biting that I don't remember. And just the fact that they were able to make comedy in this time where like literally people were saying that comedy was dead, it was very soothing, like that things are not. That, like, the culture still exists, even if it feels like so many things are changing right underneath us, which, you know, they may have said in Weimar Germany as well. It didn't help them any. But for now, it feels like holding on to something.
Yeah, I think that, you know, comedy has a good place of having to be there historically, regardless of what's been happening. So, I mean, it's give and take. Sometimes you have to find, you know, what's good for you on Facebook. Other times Saturday Night Live picks up something you could, or lays down something you could pick up. But yeah, it has to exist, I feel. And like, that's part of what also makes it super creative and cathartic.
Well, if you're looking for a dose of anti-Trump comedy and also show tunes, Randy Rainbow is on YouTube and his videos are very entertaining, and you can talk to my mom about them.
You want to lay the blame at somebody's feet? Look no further than your Democratic friends, starting with Senator Feinstein.
I don't know her.
Why is it not enough for you that a man has gone through 6 FBI vets who said he wasn't there, who's willing to testify under oath, was willing to do it last Monday?
Republicans assumed he was a shoo-in. Political control was all they saw. But look whose reputation's now in ruin. Judge Kavanaugh.
Why, who could have. All right, for our mini segment, we're going to breeze through a conversation about something we touched on last week, which is Netflix's new mini series. Probably won't come back. I can't imagine
limited
a
series.
Season 2 of this.
Limited series.
Limited series. Mini series. A teeny tiny series called Maniac. It's been created by Patrick Somerville, who I think is a novelist. He may have worked on The Leftovers. He has some TV credits under his belt. Created by this guy. It's actually a remake of I want to say it's a Norwegian television show that has almost nothing to do with this version of Maniac. But if you're interested, you can go looking for that, because it's about psychology and trauma, dealing with that. But Maniac takes a similar approach, except it is set in either the future or an alternative present.
Or an alternative past. No, I mean, it's got the very 1980s aesthetic.
Well, I see it at, no, it's more like 1990s aesthetic. But it's more like if 1990s, if technology didn't progress past the 90s, it's retrofuturism, essentially. We're kind of in a future world where the ever-present ads in our lives, instead of being internet pop-ups or billboards at Times Square, it's people who can be hired to follow you around and yell ads at you, which you can buy food for credits and then have people yell at you, and all sorts of things like that. And all the computers are very retro, and all the technology, all the visuals, there's a lot of like computer screens in this world, and it's all very retro futurist, which is neat. It actually reminds me a lot of like anime in a way. Maybe we'll unpack that in a second. But So Maniac is actually directed. All episodes are directed by Cary Joji Fukunaga of True Detective and movies. And it's
James
interesting.
Bond 25.
Oh, yeah. With the future James Bond movie. That's a wild turn of events. Stars Emma Stone, Jonah Hill. You may have seen people talking about this, or maybe not, because I feel like conversation about this really died off quickly. And it might speak to not necessarily the quality of the show. I found it to be the setup is that both Emma Stone and Jonah Hill have gone through traumatic events. They're dealing with mental stress and potentially mental illness, and they have submitted themselves to a psychological study, or maybe not even a study, a treatment, an experimental treatment, where by reliving memories, or at least entering their own minds through drug use, they will learn to cope, learn to deal, and potentially heal themselves entirely of these mental traumas. And to show us that in a filmic way, they travel through their dreams. They have episodes that might be like Paprika, that anime. They have episodes that might be more Inception-like. They have episodes that are just complete, like, fiction, alternate realities where they're meeting each other. So you bounce from this retro-futurist present to totally different fantasy worlds, or present realistic portrayals where they're playing different characters, maybe a little Charlie Kaufman-esque, if you will. And it gives, obviously, Cary Fukunaga tons to play with, and the writing is off the wall. And my takeaway was that it's all pretty surface level and a great, like, acting exercise for Emma Stone and Jonah Hill, and absolutely nothing underneath. And I wonder if that contributes to the reason I don't see that many people talking about it, despite Maniac being totally hyped, at least in our corner of the internet. So Dave and David, you have both seen this. What's your general takeaway of Maniac? Is it worth binging all 8 episodes? Did you get to the end?
I did not make it to the end. I got about 7 episodes in, and I was so... I found a lot.
There's 10 episodes, I should say. I'm sorry.
I found a lot to like about the show. The performances, the fact you didn't really know. Well, I mean, to a certain extent, you didn't really know what was going to happen next. And I liked how coherent the whole aesthetic of it was, even as it was ping-ponging between all these fantasy scenarios. But as Patches was saying, it's all incredibly superficial. And there's such a literal connection between the fantasy worlds they go into and the very simple real-world things that everything has to correspond to. And it's all, like, very, very strained in 1, 2, 3. And I found it, I don't know. Those episodes put me off so much, even though I was intrigued a little bit by the worlds that they visited. I wanted just more of these characters. Jonah Hill's such a flat affect, which they don't really stretch far enough for me to really sink in.
Yeah, he might be the wrong casting for this.
I like him, I think.
Kind of a strange choice.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if... I don't know if the character is really there on the page. Emma Stone gets to have a little bit more fun, but I didn't really... I mean, crucially, she's meant to be an addict in the first 2 episodes. It's central to her character. And maybe it's because she gets off the hook and gets a fix of what she needs. But I didn't quite feel the desperation that I think is, like, necessary to anchor that character in her addiction, and then to really bring to life the things that gave rise to her addiction in the first place, the grief and the guilt and those things. The show was a little bit too all over the place. I was reading a tweet thread or something by someone who was saying that they felt the show was a victim of Netflix's demand, that it's sort of like the new obstacle that creators on these streaming services have to deal with, whereas people creating on network TV have to worry about ratings week to week and take network notes. When you're creating for Netflix, they have algorithmically down to the, you know, all these subcategories of viewers, all of the boxes you need to hit and all of the things you need to hit to get people to keep watching. And they know what things are going to keep people watching for X number of minutes in each episode. And it just feels like it's programmed for every single one of them, and never really chooses its own path and just hopes that its path will sort of arise out of a multitude of all the lack of choices, or making every choice, whatever it is. And it all just becomes this big gumbo of stuff that didn't really satisfy me enough to see it through.
Dave, what about you? You did make it to the end. So what kept you going? Or was it your zombified couch
Netflix
spot?
Forced you.
I just had to finish it. I Emma Stone, Justin Theroux, and Sally Field are all really good in it. And they sort of propel you through. So the stopping point where David's at is either right after or right before the 26-minute episode, which is algorithmically timed, I would bet, like David's saying. So it does sort of like ease you into the end. But I also agree with Patches that at the end, when you do get to the very end of it, the substance that was sort of promised to you by the pretentiousness of the beginning isn't fulfilled in a narratively good way. There's a whole bunch of images and themes that they set up and they keep returning to throughout the show, but we don't learn anything about those images and themes so much as they just keep appearing in dreams and occasionally in real life. There's a few things they do get right, like Jonah Hill's character had this pet red hawk that he nursed back to hell, so then his brother beat its death with a hammer, and that is manifested like as an alien at some point, and at other point is like a, you know, ferret that he needs to protect. But like this sort of like innocent animal protection thing does sort of get echoed out, but then it doesn't like factor into the ending at all. So the one strongest theme that they like managed to follow through doesn't. And it ends basically trying to loop back to the beginning and making it about like human connection, which could have been summed up in the first three episodes of the series, leaving the rest just to be like a filler exercise and I don't know, pleasurable watching. It's hard to hold it against it. It's just there's no conclusion paragraph.
Yeah, it's not like I need everything to have a mystery that then circles back in an aha moment. But maybe it needed more of what Fukunaga brought to True Detective, just the murkiness of life, or even the heightened dialogue and the theatrics of an investigation, or in this case, the transcendence of exploring one's own dreams. I mentioned it at the top, but like Satoshi Kon's Paprika is one of my favorite movies of all time, and that is about stretching the imagination and delving through your dreams and coming out on the other side with revelations. And I don't think you need a big mystery. I think it just needs to like build and build and build to a climax, and this does not for some strange reason. But I think I'd recommend it. I think if you have not caught up with Maniac, it's going to be on Netflix forever. I assume. Mm-hmm. These shows don't go away, right? They can't just magically disappear one day like iTunes movies.
they don't, but, you know, to the positive, actually, in a really interesting twist of events, they started syndicating their first ever show recently when BoJack Horseman is now on Comedy Central, is very strange and unexpected, but great.
Yeah, so for opposite, someone.
You might be able to find Maniac in all kinds of places.
Yeah. In more places, yes.
Unlikely, but yeah.
So if we've intrigued you and you are a fan of retrofuturism, I would recommend Maniac. Okay, so this week launches Sony's new Spider-Verse with Venom, a long-gestating kind of Spider-Man spin-off starring Tom Hardy as...
Topher Grace? Not Topher
Eddie
Brock.
No, that was the last Venom. This is the new Venom, standalone Venom. Tom Hardy plays Eddie Brock, a journalist. He's a, like... basically hosts his own Vice show. He's a real bad boy. He has a motorcycle and doesn't take shit from no one. And he is poking around the wrong evil laboratory. Riz Ahmed plays the like an Elon Musk type who went to space, found some symbiotes, some like goopy aliens. Dave, correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong. I feel like you probably know better than me, even though I've seen the movie and you haven't.
You're doing well, really good. He works for a company called the Life Foundation.
Which is, this movie is not a sequel to Life.
What about Life itself?
It is a sequel to Life itself. After, I don't even know what happens in the movie. I can't even make a joke, but it sounds funny. But yes, the symbiotes, you know, one attaches onto Eddie Brock at some point and he becomes Venom. Hello, Eddie. Do you want to play? Yes. Yes, I do.
Is he, wait, is Venom played by Adam Sandler's voice that he puts on in Funny People?
In the Water Boy?
Doopy loopy doopy doo, Eddie Brock.
No, it's not the Water Boy. It's the voice he uses to, like, make fun of Seth Rogen in Funny People.
Oh, of wow. course. That is your Adam Sandler touchstone.
It's a reference voice. Just for David, actually.
Yeah.
No, it's more of the movie is totally convoluted. It's like part generic blockbuster from the early 2000s, like a total Sony move. This has nothing to do with the MCU or any of that. It's very straightforward and obviously rewritten to high heavens. Like who knows how many hands are all over this thing. But the twist here is that Venom is kind of fun, and most of it comes down to Tom Hardy just having a blast. He plays Eddie Brock and Venom. You know, this is all an internal conflict that he's having. He starts off the movie, he's like Gwyneth Paltrow in Contagion when the symbiote hits him, and he's having a total physical mental meltdown. And when they really start to click, he becomes, it's like Little Shop of Horrors if it starred mid-90s Jim Carrey. It's totally off the wall and out of control, and he gives it a physical performance, and it was really fun. So when it's not being giant splattered CG goop fighting between two symbiotes, it's Tom Hardy going ballistic, and I would definitely watch another
ballistic
Venom movie.
X vs. Sever?
Different action movie, not a superhero movie. I don't know. You're just riffing. And I think the broader conversation for us all to have, since no one's seen Venom and it's potentially going to, I don't know, Dave, is this movie going to bomb or is this going to spawn an actual Spider-Verse this time? You may know how it's going.
Can I tell you, because I made a prediction today that I think is going to be accurate.
Yes.
Yeah, I got
sorry
it.
To step on Dave's toes. I think we've got a Ang Lee's Hulk on our hands. I think
really?
It's been tracking really well, surprisingly well. And I think it's going to open in like the $65 million range, if not higher.
And just
A little bit lower if the tracking underestimated the box office juggernaut that is A Star Is Born.
But I'm the juggernaut.
Whatever it does this weekend, which will be a pretty impressive number, it will tank like you will not believe next weekend. It's going to fall off something like 70%.
I do think the reviews will be bad. I'm guessing like 40% because I do think this movie is going to have a slight critical
following. It's going to be higher.
Following.
You mean 40% the Rotten Tomatoes?
Rotten Tomatoes. 40% Rotten Tomatoes.
Because I'm saying 70% box office tip.
Rotten
Tomatoes is going to be 70%.
It's not going to do Deadpool business, but the fandom for Venom is definitely there. I mean, so the big question that I think we can sift through comic book history here and talk a little about Hollywood as a functioning business and what stars mean and why, and a little conjecture about like what famous people, actors and actresses really get out of doing these movies. I, having seen Venom, I can understand why Tom Hardy would do it. Apparently he was a big fan of the Venom character in the first place, so that's a logical reason why you would come on board with a little producing cred and try and shape this into something that you want to do. It's a performance vehicle for him, and he absolutely goes for it. He's working with Ruben Fleischer, who he can steamroll clearly in any situation.
Yeah, that guy.
I talked to.
He does not stop working.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's no offense to him, but he shoots for the suits, right? He's just like, I can make this movie. I can make this movie. And then Tom Hardy is like, you know, all the stories of Tom Hardy are true. He goes on the set and he figures out what to do right then and there. So I talked to Ruben Fleischer about making the movie, and there's this one scene where Eddie Brock is going crazy. The symbiote is taking over his brain and is very hungry. He needs to feed himself. And after eating like 3 bags of frozen tater tots at his apartment, he runs into the streets of San Francisco and tracks down his ex-girlfriend, Michelle Williams, and bursts into dinner. And he's in a really fancy restaurant, just like ripping steaks off plates and chowing down on them. And then at some point he jumps into a lobster tank and starts feasting upon live lobsters. Okay. So in this scene, the lobster tank was just like scene dressing or set dressing. And Tom Hardy apparently arrived to set and was like, I have to jump in that lobster tank. I will be gnawing on lobsters by the end of the scene. And they had to like redo the whole thing for him. And that's how these movies are made somehow. And that's why they cost a shit ton of money. But like Tom Hardy obviously found a situation where he could command a little bit of the action, but I don't think that's necessarily common throughout superhero cinema. And I look back at, you know, this is the 10th anniversary of Iron Man, the MCU. It's obviously changed Hollywood and the movie industry forever. But who's come out of this with, like, something to gain, or who's made it their own, and has anyone in the long history
of
comic
actors?
Book movies? Yeah, actors or actresses. You know, anybody who has made something out of superhero cinema, and why do people keep signing up for it? Jake Gyllenhaal is going to be the villain. I just saw a picture of a silly costume in Spider-Man 2.
Just one question. Have you heard of Money?
I have heard of money.
Wait. I think, let me tweak his question a little bit.
Yes, please.
Like, who got to actually make a character out of it would probably be a good question. Because I think, like, the lineup of the, you know, the Marvel Chrises, they're gonna be known as those characters. Like, they definitely put a brand on it. But did any of them really do arcs? Like, Thor doesn't have an arc. Thor isn't a performance. Thor is Chris Hemsworth being likable. As likable as he can be in whatever director's, like, plot movie needs to introduce a new Infinity Stone. But I think, like, Captain America, through luck, and maybe definitely through performance, but maybe just through luck, has, like, slightly a little bit more of an arc, assuming that, you know, he's gonna die in the next one, because that would complete the arc. But that makes me feel like Chris Evans' performance might be, like, sort of what we're looking for out of the superhero era.
Well, I think
we're gonna have movies that serve the dumb plot regardless, because Marvel knows that works and people show up for them, and we're gonna have comic book adaptation characters in name only now, I think, because we've moved away from straight adaptations, which is nice. And so now I think the answer to your question is we've made an opening for superhero performances for the first time since Iron Man.
Well, two things to that. First off, Chris Evans has the more iconic performance and will forever be known as Captain America. I think it would be harder to reinvent that character while he's still around and potentially able to fill that role. So I think you'd have to bring him back for future MCU movies. And I don't think it's really served him. I don't think he's grown to be a better actor or who can subvert that. I just think he's kind of like, he has,
but his star power has grown, like he can get,
I don't think so
made. You don't, I'm, think well, that he like got cast in Snowpiercer because he could sell Snowpiercer?
I mean, maybe a little bit, but I don't think it's helped him challenge the notion of who he is as an actor. I think he's become kind of one note outside that. And whereas,
yes, but lest we forget that this bought Chris Evans his directorial debut, which was a
which
movie
Noah saw.
I saw, and no one else did. That's because it wasn't very good. But
also, Chris Evans was like the smarmy guy from the Fantastic Four movies, and like whatever.
He's done it twice.
Yeah, but as Captain America, he's something totally different. I think it has changed his career maybe more than anyone except Robert Downey Jr.
I guess what I'm thinking is that Chris Hemsworth is actually more successful in terms of using the Marvel movies to his advantage. He's not only come away and, you know, had a little star power and made the movies and been an attraction, but also he has warped those movies in his direction. He is a funny man.
He's very
more of a side
player. Bad Times at the El Royale.
He does some amazing topless dancing in that movie that is coming out soon.
He's old.
But his persona has changed.
2 hours to get there,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah,
he does not show
long.
Up until the end.
It's a very long movie.
Come in.
But he has made the Thor movies work for him, which is interesting. Not many people have been able to do that. But David, the one thing I wanted to say to, you know, the obvious thing is you get a lot of money when you're in one of these movies, but they can also tank you. I feel like the Amazing Spider-Man movies did not work in Andrew Garfield's, for his career. In fact, it kind of sullied him, despite him actually being good as a Spider-Man and him obviously having a huge payday. Or like Nicolas Cage, the Ghost Rider movies were the last like main big screen thing he'll ever do. And
you mean Mandy's Nicolas Cage?
I mean Mandy's Nicolas Cage.
You mean
that's a comeback?
Fucking Angels in America's Andrew Garfield. Fucking
Tony winner Andrew Garfield.
Yeah, I mean, under
who cares about
Lake
a Tony?
May never see the light of day.
He won a Tony.
No one cares about the Tonys. Come on,
Andrew Garfield. It was definitely his profile was raised many times. They're using Heartbreak Ridge, which is an awful movie.
Hacksaw Ridge.
It made a lot of money, even though it's terrible. And I think less of Andrew Garfield for doing it. But
Silence.
Silence fucking rules.
I'm not silencing you. He was in Silence.
No, silence. You're silencing. You don't get cast in Silence opposite Adam Driver if you've not played Spider-Man.
So true.
It's like the first rule of Hollywood.
But is that what we're looking for? We're looking for somebody who could exploit the opportunity to the best of their ability?
I think that is...
Either that or create an interesting performance, which often neither happens.
Yes, that's true. Because I think people, I don't know. Sometimes in fandom, there's why hasn't, such and such gotten their superhero role? Why isn't Idris Elba James Bond yet? And it's if they don't have a reason to create a compelling character of it, if they aren't a Tom Hardy of it, or if they don't have the, power to bend it in their business way, if they aren't a Chris Hemsworth about it, some people still take those jobs because why not be in a superhero movie if it pays enough and it's the Hollywood trend?
Well that seems to be the Michelle Williams
right
to Venom. I see Michelle Williams is in it, and I think she's given interviews that are essentially it seemed fine, and I got a kid to raise, so
she's actually pretty good in it too.
And she has that. She was good in Oz the Great and Powerful, which is a ridiculous movie.
She was very good in I Feel Pretty, which is another ridiculous movie.
Sure. Yeah. She has a knack for this, and she can kind of show up and do something thankless. I mean, with Tom Hardy, it seems obvious he's getting the chance to stretch his chops, but he's just in a different position than an Andrew Garfield when he starts as Spider-Man, or Chris Hemsworth, where he's established, he's got an Oscar nomination, he'll be in whatever Christopher Nolan makes. He doesn't need this as a career step. It's similar to what Joaquin Phoenix is doing in Joker, where you don't need this dude. So what are you getting out of this? And maybe it's the same kind of thing of stretching, or maybe Joaquin Phoenix is trolling us all. It's really hard to know.
I mean, if you look back at old interviews of Jack Nicholson playing the Joker, he was really fucking into it. He's here's my performance. Here's, how the makeup's going to be. Here's why this feeds into that. And so there's the ability to stretch into a great performance if the actor wants to go there. But I think a lot of people approach it, especially villains, as just now's my time. I've been cast. I've been called up from the minors to the Disney MCU. And,
well, feel inevitable.
I'm Eccleston, and I'm playing a dark elf.
Well, especially for some levels of character actors. If you are a Ron Perlman or a Christopher Eccleston or a Lee Pace or whatever, and you haven't played a villain yet in a superhero movie, it's all right, any minute now.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who on those people have all done
but
it.
But see, Lee Pace is coming back. So what... does that mean he really enjoyed it?
No.
Does he think he's...
That means
he signed a contract where he has to come back.
That means he couldn't make it work. He couldn't make that work for him. And of course he couldn't, because Ronan the Accuser is a horrible villain and Guardians is a
wait, is he coming back as a different character?
No, he's coming back as Ronan the Accuser, your favorite Marvel villain.
Of course. Remember him well.
But yeah, it's just that we don't get the heroes to loop back to Nicolas Cage. One of the things he always talked about doing the Ghost Rider movies, and especially Spirit of Vengeance. Is that what it's called? Wow, pulled that out of my ass.
So.
It was that he could do this Baroque acting. That's the word he uses, Baroque. When he, even though his face is not going to be on screen, when he's spitting, vomiting fire out of his mouth as Ghost Rider.
Doesn't call it expressionist acting?
I remember doing a video junket with him where he was wearing 18 rings and going, Baroque acting.
All right, because I've also been at a junket acting where he's expressionist, the German expressionist. They do poses.
I think it's entirely possible.
All of the above. All of the above.
It's the same junket. Expressionist. Fucking with you guys.
Yeah. Got to get the quotes. But I don't see anyone. Do you see anyone in, the MCU is on this pedestal and Venom is going to get bad reviews, I think. Partially because it doesn't gel together, but partially because people are just kind of overlook what Tom Hardy does in this movie and see it as spastic drivel. But I think he's really doing something there. But I don't get a lot of that from the Marvel movies, which are kind of on a pedestal. Do you see someone in the MCU or this new wave of superhero movies making it work for them performance-wise?
I'm predisposed to thinking this, but I thought that even though she had a nothing of the part, Cate Blanchett did a good job in Ragnarok. Even though, again, really every meaningful or memorable moment in there has to be wrestled from the tedium of the screenplay. What else? Fuck it. I mean, a lot of people in Black Panther.
Well, I mean, like there, a lot there are of people good performances in Black Panther. In there, but like no oh, one. Yeah. yeah, but I don't think there is going to be like when we look back at the MCU, there might be a list of greatest performances in the MCU.
Yeah,
if we're talking about their contribution to like action and movies.
Yes.
Like, no, I don't think there's one in there.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah. I'm looking back at like X-Men and even Spider-Man, like. Tobey Maguire. Shouldn't Tobey Maguire been a better, bigger star after the Spider-Man movies? Or shouldn't
he? No, because Tobey Maguire was a bad Spider-Man.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
Said it then, and I stand there.
All right, well, good night. It's been a good time recording.
Or even thinking about like the X-Men movies, which I don't know that I would take over a lot of the MCU movies, but like Michael Fassbender's doing something in his X-Men movies that I don't think you're seeing in the primary Marvel movies.
That's true, but now he's about to do it for like the 18th. Same time in this Dark Phoenix movie. It looks like the exact same thing. He's really wrung dry. I don't know.
I mean, these, at least at their core, they're built to be such arch characters. And they're dealing with, like, sky portals and the world blowing up. Like, I'm not necessarily sure that's what I'm looking for. When I happen across, you know, when you get a Heath Ledger coming around, that at least, you know, elevates it to the point where it's in the actual conversation of general good performances, then I think that's a bonus, but I don't think that's what Marvel's trying to create. And because Marvel's the new gold standard, I think sadly things like Venom are going to be few and far between.
Yeah, Marvel doesn't have to promise the ability to give a memorable performance to get these huge actors to sign on.
Marvel doesn't need to make one movie good anymore because they're just going to keep coming and you're okay with them. So one movie doesn't need to be good. You're going to see the fucking next one.
Ugh.
So that means it's less likely that you're going to show up for a performance, even when it's laid out, even when James Spader is playing a killer robot, which on paper is a sentence that says like, fucking show up for this movie. And it can be dull because it's all serving this franchise machine.
To kind of wrap up here, I'm realizing that we're just talking about A-list people who are kind of like stepping down. That's condescending, but stepping down into these comic book movies, even the DC movies of late. I realize that the person we're really talking about here is Gal Gadot, who is a little unknown. I guess she was in the Fast and Furious movies, but Gal Gadot is probably the closest thing we have to Christopher Reeve, right? In Superman, like more of an unknown person who can become Superman and then step away and do other things and ride that fame and then continue to drift back into Superman movies, or he's iconic. He'll be that forever, but he was obviously able to do many other things and become, the notoriety was there beyond his actual Superman career. But then he'll always be attached to that role. He really made it work for him. And maybe Gal Gadot is in the same boat, but I'm not sure we'll ever see like another unknown type kind of step into these roles. After these Spider-Man movies, after Andrew Garfield.
What about Tom Holland? Can never remember where it was.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing. You need more teen superheroes. You need younger people, but that's all going on television. Wow, yeah, maybe Spider-Man Homecoming is the last one. But he kind of had cred, too. What was he in before Spider-Man Homecoming? The Impossible. Everyone loved that
film.
Yeah, he had
like
especially
kid
David.
Cred. Like, now he's like a
little
man.
Did Matt Patch just say he loved The Impossible?
No, I said you loved The Impossible.
Okay, because I was going to say, I really should have just stopped recording when Dave was saying Tobey Maguire was a bad
Spider-Man. I think Katie and I saw
The
Impossible together at Toronto, and we liked it.
I don't know if we loved it. I feel like we were overpowered by it.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I don't know what the number is. Like, it's one of the worst X movies, but it's one of the worst X movies of the 21st century. 25... 30, you name it, I don't care. It's up there.
I have an idea for how to end the segment.
Yes.
If you were to pick a, like, what is the best performance you have seen in a Marvel movie of this current iteration? Do you have, like, an automatic pick?
The best performance in a Marvel movie?
Yeah.
Big or small? Doesn't have to be a title character.
I don't think so.
MCU or extended Marvel?
I was thinking MCU. The example I was thinking of was Ben Kingsley in Iron Man 3, which is a movie that I don't love, but his character and the way that turns the movie on its head and what he's doing in there is a performance. It's a real character. It's a real moment that is lively and doesn't feel pre-planned like the rest of Marvel movies.
We should probably nod to Hugh Jackman at some point in this conversation. But again,
that's true.
I'm not sure he's made it work for him.
Hang on.
Oh,
that's nuts.
might be nuts.
Yeah, I mean, Logan was the greatest showman, and he had the greatest showman. Like, yeah, Hugh Jackman is a massive movie star. On
and
Power
my mom
Wolverine.
Knows who Hugh Jackman is. Right, Hugh Jackman right. is.
Yeah,
Hugh Jackman.
Hugh Jackman is an excellent early Gal Gadot example.
He
what
turned.
You're, about.
You're right. He was not well known before getting cast in.
Definitely,
yeah, but Hugh Jackman was in The Prestige, and Gal Gadot was not. So
she'll get there. Yeah,
better in the remake.
Time. And he turned the Wolverine into his James Bond. Someone else will take that mantle, and we'll always be talking about Hugh Jackman.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a big deal. I shouldn't undervalue that. This was really just me biding time trying to figure out who my Marvel pick is, but I'm going to defer to Dave.
Yeah, Dave, do you have one?
Oh, my heart says Tom Holland, because I think he's going, there's a purity in him that is going to make him the through line through this transition period between what the MCU was and what the MCU is. I think that it was really great of them to latch onto Infinity War. But I think the real answer has to be Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
Because if you would have told me comic book fan, in 2003, what Iron Man would be, it would have been like this drunk character who's wearing like this bullshit thing that nobody would take seriously, that no way it would have worked, but it did, and it was a creation of Robert Downey Jr. and Jon Favreau.
My answer is Haley Atwell in Captain America, the first.
That's a good answer.
Ooh, that's good. That's a good answer.
David, do you have an answer? Do you dare?
No.
His answer is himself during the MCU marathon.
That is correct. I had the greatest performance, and it was required of me to come out of that alive.
Best achievement in loud theatrical sighs.
I got a song filled with shish for the strong-willed. When the world gives you a raw.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. Never fear, we will talk about A Star is Born next week. And David will probably sing all of The Shallow underneath our discussion of A Star is Born. So look forward to that. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
We are Venom, and we're the senior.
Is Venom a collective?
He goes by, they say we are Venom.
He speaks like that. Yes, he does.
Hello, Eddie. Hello. That's how he talks. I'm Matt Patches, senior entertainment editor at Polygon.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them with friends, you can leave your most venomous comments, and fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm a senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. If I'm writing on IndieWire, you can find all of us listening to the Star is Born soundtrack in 2 days from now if you're listening on the day that it drops. October 5th, May 11th, Infamy. You can find all of us also after that, or during that, on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
We are going to talk about Star is Born next week.
Oh, it literally said that.
Oh. When did you say that?
At the beginning of this outro, like a minute.
Emily!
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me on Thrillist.com this week talking about the origins of Venom and his symbiote family. So it's a super, super deep dive into 80s comics, in which I found Donald Trump references. It was kind of traumatic.
Is his hair a symbiote?
It was pretty scary. Anyway, Star Wars spoilers this week, because it's been weird, is talking about feel-good media. And then next week, we're all going to dive into Venom. So, feel good this week. Good Place is back. What is it? Empire Records is on Netflix now. Do something to feel good about yourself. And then listen to Storm of Spoilers.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com and on the Little Gold Men podcast there, where I talk this week to Elsie Fisher, star of 8th grade, who is delightful and funny and not as awkward as her character, which argues even more for her performance is great. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR. where you can talk to us about all kinds of things or answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Venom, up until this weekend, what was the most notable cinematic tongue?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
I said knock knock, let the devil in, alien, it Elliot, phone home, ain't no telling when this chokehold on this game will end, I'm loco, became a symbiote, so my fangs are in your throat, you're snake bitten with my venom, with the ballpoint venom, gun cock, bump stock, double lock, buckshot, tie it up, a hooker rot.